Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So Facebook launched this new feature today, makes it even easier to keep tabs on where your friends are, because hourly posts clearly aren't enough. Sound a tad creepy? Well, then perhaps you'd like a little internet security, courtesy of Intel? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, committed to customer service with the option to reach a human being at any time at 877-247-ALLY by pressing 0. And by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the 19th day of August. The world's largest chip maker is now in the business of keeping the data on those chips in lockdown. Today, Intel announced it's acquiring McAfee, the software security firm, for $7.7 billion. It's the latest in a string of large corporate deals. Earlier this week, Dell purchased storage company 3PAR, and BHP Billiton launched a hostile bid for fertilizer giant Potash. In the wake of the recession, companies are working to get their fiscal houses in order. They're putting off hiring and avoiding big capital purchases. And now some are spending that hoarded cash on mergers and acquisitions. Janet Babin reports.
Silicon Valley giant Intel is known for its hardware, processors, computer chips. McAfee is synonymous with software, security software, and customer services. So this acquisition flummoxed many analysts. But tech analyst Tim Beharin at Creative Strategies says computer chips and security software go well together.
There are actually a lot of creative ways you can find to tie security to the hardware that makes this deal make more sense.
As in a security system built right into Intel's next-generation chips. Beharin says McAfee could help Intel do that. It could also push the company into gadgets and smartphones. Michael Gartenberg, with research firm Altimeter Group, says Intel wants to be known for securing PCs and handheld devices.
In a world of connected devices, secure connections is extremely important, and I suspect that probably had something to do with why they paid the price.
And it's a steep one. Intel offered a 60% premium for McAfee shares. Like many companies, Intel tightened its belt during the recession and is sitting on lots of cash. Last month, it reported its largest quarterly profit in a decade. Steve Nelson's a venture capitalist at the Wakefield Group. He says more companies are now looking to make deals, but there's still a high bar to getting them done.
Until we get the job market back where we need it and consumer confidence with it, people willing to take some risks, and that includes businesses, I still think the real health could be a year or two away.
Real health is closer, though, than it was in 2008. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
General Motors filed the papers for its long-anticipated initial public offering late yesterday. You should be able to buy shares of the carmaker sometime in October. Now, there's lots of chatter about that timing, right before the midterm elections. An IPO could let the government, which owns 61% of GM, brag that it saved the car industry and recouped its investment. But as Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us, there is more to going public than just politics.
There's been speculation for months about when GM might be ready to go public again. Part of it is about wondering when we, that is the taxpayers, might get some of our investment back. But going public is also a way for GM to show that it's back, that it hasn't just emerged from bankruptcy, but that it's really making it as a company. Marianne Keller is an independent auto analyst, and she says GM probably could raise more money if it waited longer to launch the IPO, assuming the economy gets better. But she thinks not being owned by the government is more important than the share price.
You also have a company that I think needs to become self-funding, has to be able to access other forms of capital. Becoming public is part of that greater process.
Going public will let investors and lenders compare GM directly with its competition. That's important for a lot of reasons, one of which is that GM needs to be able to borrow a lot of money. And if everybody can see how it's doing, it can get much better rates from lenders. Bruce Belzowski is a researcher at the Transportation Research Institute at the University of Michigan. He's worried that going public again could hurt GM.
Do they return to short-term thinking versus long-term thinking for their company?
He says public companies often get too caught up in trying to please Wall Street, and they forget to do what's best for the company. He says one problem GM's management had before was thinking too much about short-term results.
The finance guys get too much into that, and they lose track of the product, and they lose track of what the company stands for.
And that's vehicles, not stock price. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
I finally, reluctantly, joined Facebook a couple of weeks ago. Late to the party, I know. Turns out it's very much like a party. Fun parts, and seriously dull parts. Like reading where you ate dinner last night. But now, I don't even have to read a post to know about that dinner. I can find out where you are at any given moment in time, thanks to Facebook Places. It's the next step in a predicted internet smackdown between Facebook and Google, Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Facebook's Places feature works something like this. You decide to go out to a restaurant. You hop on your iPhone and check in, sending out a status update to all your Facebook friends with your location. If they see your update, they might want to join you, or the restaurant owner might offer you a free drink if you post. Letting friends pinpoint friends is just another way of keeping them on Facebook longer, and another way Facebook is taking on Google.
At the end of the day, people only have a limited amount of time.
Ray Valdez is a tech analyst at Gartner. He says even though the experience of using Google and Facebook are different, there's a fight for people's internet attention. There may soon be fights over local ad dollars, too. Facebook didn't say how it plans to make money with the new service, but analyst Deborah Aho-Williamson with eMarketer says there are plenty of possibilities.
I really believe sooner rather than later that marketing is going to be a very integral part of this, and that's where Facebook is going to generate some new revenue.
Because Facebook knows so much about you, who you are, where you are, and what you like, that can make it easy for advertisers to tailor their message. Like other Facebook applications, Places has raised some privacy concerns. You can use the feature to broadcast not only where you are, but where your friends are, without their permission. And Williamson says it's easy to make stupid mistakes.
There's always going to be people who are not so smart and go to a baseball game when they're supposed to be at work and check in there and forget that their boss is one of their friends on Facebook.
Might be time to review your friend list. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, yet another week of rising claims for jobless benefits sent investors scurrying for the exits. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Facebook is one of the more high-profile inventions of the last couple of years. No doubt they've got all kinds of patents on their business model and technology, which would make them the lucky ones. Right now, applicants for patent protection are waiting an average of 3 years to get their papers reviewed. Each and every one of them represents an idea that could turn into a business that could create jobs. So the head of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, David Kappos, is trying to grease the wheels. He joins us now. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on, Tess.
So talk to us a little bit about why there is such an enormous backlog there at the Patent Office.
Americans are very creative, very inventive, and for the last more than 10 years have filed an incredible and increasing number of patent applications. And unfortunately, our agency here, the United States Patent and Trademark Office, just literally has not been able to keep up. Our backlog is currently about double what it should be. So we've gone to where we've had a backlog as high as over 750,000 applications here.
Sounds like you need somebody to invent a new system for you.
Yeah, that's right. Well, what we need and what we're doing is we turned overtime on to let our examiners, who are very productive people, help get on top of our backlog. We have provided new IT equipment to our examiners immediately to enable them to work more effectively. And we've done really simple things also, like simply turning the air conditioning on here at the USPTO on weekends so people can come in and work. And we're making good progress in that regard. We're starting to get some signs that it's dropping significantly for the first time since about 2006.
Now, the patent process actually is not that expensive. It's, what, $500 to $1,000. Have you thought about raising that maybe to raise some money?
Yes, the patent process is relatively modestly priced. For a large entity like a business, it costs about $1,000 to file a patent application. Individuals and small businesses cost them about $500. That is intended to incent applicants to enter the system. We want people to come and work with the USPTO. We want to see patent applications, and we don't want to discourage filings. So while we could potentially raise the filing rate, we certainly want to keep it modest enough and reasonable enough that American innovators will feel that our fees are not an impediment to entering the patent system.
Now, you have been talking quite a bit about how this is actually affecting the country's ability to recover from the unemployment problem. Explain for us why that is.
Well, that's exactly right. The reason is because patents create jobs. Patents enable innovators to put products and services in the marketplace and to hire people. They create opportunity and they put Americans to work. And so every patent application that's sitting here in our agency is potentially American jobs that aren't being created.
Obviously, there are issues that you're trying to rectify within the patent office itself, but we always hear that one of the good things that come out of tough economic times is that people do come up with new and different ways of doing things out of almost desperation. So are you finding that the last couple of years have been particularly fruitful for you?
We are what you might call a fairly recession-proof agency in the sense that even during the recession, our filing rate dropped only very slightly, which I think, Tess, is an indicator of the point that you're on. This year, our application filing rate has gone up a little over 4%, which is quite a bounce back. And again, an indication that Americans are doubling down on their investment in innovation.
David Kapos is the director of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Thank you so much for your time today.
You bet. Thank you very much, Tess.
Americans buy about $1 billion worth of olive oil every year. More than 99% of it is imported from the Mediterranean. If you've wandered the oil and vinegar aisle in the supermarket, you know that extra virgin olive oil commands a premium price. But hold the dressing. A recent study found that many of those top shelf oils are not as virginal as we think. April Demboski reports.
So this row here...
Dan Flynn is an olive researcher at the University of California at Davis. He walks me through the campus olive orchards lined with Mission, Manzanillo, and Kalamata trees.
Probably 25 different varieties that come from Spain, Italy, France, Greece.
He holds a sprig of olive leaves up to the sunlight. It looks just like an image you'd see on a bottle of olive oil in the supermarket. And it's what's inside those bottles that Dan Flynn is interested in. His researchers tested 19 brands of extra virgin olive oil to see just how virgin they really were. A panel of accredited tasters tested the oils first, and two-thirds of imported oils that claimed to be extra virgin didn't taste extra virgin.
One could describe it as the taste of crayons, for example, or an old catcher's mitt.
Next, researchers took the oils to the lab. They measured them against virginity standards set by European and Australian olive councils.
We did a number of different chemistry tests, which can tell you whether the oil is oxidized, meaning it's been exposed too much to heat or light or age.
California Oils did much better. Only 10% failed the test. But the study was funded by California growers. Companies who import olive oil to the U.S. are suspicious. Bob Bauer is the president of the trade group that represents foreign producers. He's especially wary of the taste test results.
The people who do this type of testing, they can readily tell if an oil is from the Mediterranean, from California, or from Australia, since they most likely knew who was paying for them to conduct this test. It had to be create some sort of bias.
As for the science, Bauer's group has done their own chemical tests. He says his company's labs in Spain found very few problems. All this fighting over virginity isn't much help for consumers trying to decide which bottle to put in their grocery basket. There are no regulations governing the purity of olive oil.
You know, when you go down an olive oil aisle, there may be 40 different olive oils. And you've got to kind of decide, you know, is it worth paying the $16.99 versus the $9.99?
Rain Pegg is with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The agency wants to create consistency in the marketplace, so it will update its definitions of virgin and extra virgin olive oil this October.
It actually creates a level playing field in the U.S. when marketing products. So processors can begin to use this to certify that what I'm selling you is really what the label says on the front.
But the new standards are voluntary. They only apply to companies that want to put the USDA seal of approval on their product. And that's not a big marketing plus for foreign olive oils who've come to rely on images of verdant olive groves or Tuscan villas on their label. In Davis, California, I'm April Domboski for Marketplace.
Coming up, the pain caused by the Gulf oil spill.
I mean, I literally ache behind my knees when I think about the death of so many, like, sea creatures.
And BP might have to pay her for that. But first, let's do the numbers. Troubling reports on jobs and manufacturing crushed the markets today. The Dow slumped 1.3%, 144 points to close at 10,271. The Nasdaq barreled down 1.75%, 36 points to end at 2178. And the S&P 500 crumbled 1.75%, 18 points to finish at 1075. Staples slid 3.5% after it announced flat sales in the second quarter. OfficeMax unclipped more than 5%. Software security firm McAfee locked in a 57% gain on the news of that merger with Intel that we mentioned earlier. Intel chipped off more than 3%. Hewlett-Packard and Dell were both more than 1% lower ahead of their earnings releases. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.57%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering more young people to achieve educational success beyond high school. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases data on mass layoffs for July. That's when 50 or more workers from a single employer lose their job. Batter up! The Little League World Series gets underway in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. And Led Zeppelin vocalist Robert Plant turns 62. Ramble on. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Tomorrow, Libya will mark the first anniversary of the controversial release of the Lockerbie bomber. Abdel Basset El-Megrahi was serving a life sentence for the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. 270 people, most of them Americans, died in the attack. But last year, El-Megrahi was set free from a Scottish jail after just 8 years. Now a Senate committee is investigating whether the release happened for business reasons to benefit the British oil giant BP. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
It was billed as an act of compassion. 1 year ago, Scotland's Justice Minister, Kenny McCaskill, released the Lockerbie bomber on the grounds that he had less than 3 months to live.
On the basis of the medical evidence given to me, I have returned him to Libya to die.
But 1 year later, El-Megrahi still isn't dead. The decision to set him free now looks naive at best. Professor Robert Kirby is a cancer specialist.
It was a big mistake to let him out on the premise that he would be dead within 3 months. That was always likely to end up to be embarrassingly wrong.
Kirby says the decision did not take into account the obvious possibility that El-Megrahi would receive chemotherapy in Libya. Critics claim the release is incredibly suspect, especially since Britain's biggest oil company, BP, has acquired drilling rights in Libya. US Senator Robert Menendez is chairing a Senate investigation, raising questions about the case.
What were the circumstances that led to El-Megrahi's release? Did BP play a role in those factors because of a deal with Libya to the tune of $900 million?
BP points out that it signed its deal with Libya 2 years before El-Megrahi was set free, and it denies it ever lobbied for his release. But skeptics say that even after signing the deal, BP would still need to curry favour with the Libyan regime. And Senator Menendez claims there is evidence of lobbying by BP representatives.
There is a business group of which BP is one of the prime sponsors that made a direct communication with the Scottish minister and said that we believe very strongly you should give El-Megrahi, you know, a release.
These were the jubilant scenes in Tripoli when El-Megrahi returned a year ago. More celebrations are scheduled tomorrow to mark the first anniversary of his return. More fuel for the Senate inquiry, more embarrassment for BP. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Today, the man in charge of overseeing the response to BP's other embarrassment, the oil spill, said the runaway well should be finally and permanently capped early next month. Meanwhile, the company says it will make good on promises to compensate Gulf Coast residents and workers who suffered financially because of the spill. One question for the courts is just who has suffered. You may be surprised to learn how far the definition of suffering can be taken. For example, were you nauseated by photos of oil-smothered birds? Chrissy Clark has our story.
First, of course, there are the people whose damages are all too obvious. In places like Coden Bayou, along Alabama's Gulf Coast, the hurt from the spill is painfully clear. Ask Lisa Harbin. She was the manager of a bait and tackle shop here until it shut down earlier this summer.
We're actually on a dock right now that we had just built for our customers to be able to come back and purchase more bait if needed, and now we're just standing on an empty dock.
No boats, no customers, no fishing since the oil started gushing. And even now, as fishing grounds reopen, people are spooked, worried local species are tainted.
We're just hoping to get open back up and hopefully people will start fishing again.
Harbin and thousands of other Gulf residents have filed claims with BP over these losses. They want compensation for the fish they haven't been able to sell or eat or catch and release. That is, what they haven't been able to use, what economists call diminished use value. But that's not where the damages of the oil spill end.
Do I hear 220? 220.
Far away from the Gulf, people have also suffered damages in places like this bar in Los Angeles. Folks held a charity auction here recently to raise money to clean up the oil spill.
You can buy some Dove to clean a pelican. 240 right there! All right, 240, here we go!
Now, unlike the manager of that bait shop, the people in this bar don't rely on income from Gulf wildlife. But as Harvard economist Robert Stavins says,
that surely doesn't mean that people don't derive value from the existence of those animals.
And that's what economists call non-use value. It's the idea that some people just feel better knowing that nature's doing okay. They put a value in that. And when it's not?
I mean, I literally ache behind my knees when I think about the pain and suffering and death of so many, like, sea creatures and the tragedy.
That's Sam Rader. I caught up with her as she was heading into the auction. A reaction like hers to the oil spill isn't uncommon. So the next question is, should BP compensate Sam Rader and folks like her? That's what I asked Nick Flores, an economist at the University of Colorado.
It does sound kind of patently ridiculous, but at the same time, I would say she's worse off than had it not happened. There's real harm there.
And by U.S. law, that harm should be compensated. People don't get the money. State and federal governments do. The question is, how much? Flores was on a team that helped figure that out after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. They carefully crafted surveys to measure how much money the average American lost knowing a bay in Alaska had been trashed. The next step?
Basically show up at people's doors and do in-person interviews with them.
The result? $31 per U.S. household, or almost $3 billion in total. It was part of the settlement that Exxon eventually paid. Of course, some people think it's crazy to price what seems priceless, like MIT economist Jerry Hausman. He worked for Exxon after the Valdez spill. He says when you ask random people to quantify the value of a pristine place like Prince William Sound,
most of those people have never thought about Prince William Sound for 20 seconds in their life. It's extraordinarily hypothetical. People don't have experience, and therefore you can't measure it.
If something is not quantified, it is simply ignored.
Robert Stavins, the economist at Harvard, says even if the calculations aren't perfect, they're worth trying.
If you don't put a price tag on it, then society judges the value to be zero.
At the Coden Bayou Bait Shop, Lisa Harbin is finishing up inventory on her tangible losses, including a freezer full of unusable bait. But then her mind wanders to the intangibles.
You know, I've seen the oil, you know, floating in the tide lines. And when you've grown up on these waters your entire life, it's heartbreaking. I cried.
The government is already assembling a new team of economists to figure out just how much those tears, or anyone's, are worth. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, we can blame the financial crisis for many things, but we can also credit it with making us all a little smarter. You now know what quantitative easing is, right? And what it means to be overleveraged? Oh, you don't? Well, then I suggest you look them up, because now you can. They're among the new entries in this year's edition of the Oxford Dictionary, along with buzzkill, bromance, and chillax. As in, chillax, Bernanke. Your quantitative easing is such a buzzkill. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 144 points, 1.3%. The NASDAQ barreled down 36 points, 1.2%. And the S&P 500 crumbled 18 points, also 1.2%. Our editors include John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, a conversation from the corner office of the CEO of Zappos.
Our number one priority as a company is company culture, and our whole belief is that if we get the culture right, then most of the other stuff will just happen naturally.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.